Welcome to Nerds Amalgamated, a podcast that covers the latest events in science, pop culture, and gaming.
I'm the professor, aspiring game developer, sci-fi aficionado, and completely and undeniably a geek trying to take over the world. I'll be breaking down the news from tech to gaming.
I am the DJ, a humble nerd, a big weeb,
and a watcher from the halls of the multiverse.
Just kidding. Anyways, I'll be breaking down all things comics to movies to anime.
Join us and stay hydrated as we quench you with witty banter, unintentionally hilarious hot takes, and trivia more fun than a night at the pub, courtesy of Nerds Amalgamated.
Welcome to another episode, Nerds Amalgamated. I am the DJ, and with me today I have the indomitable force known as the Professor. How about that?
Only indomitable? You underestimate my power.
Calm down, Palpatine. Calm down. How have you been?
Just peachy.
Oh, yeah? What happened?
Got an old network attached storage device that I've been trying to do up.
Uh-huh.
And I accidentally hit the wrong command and erased everything, including the bootloader. So I've spent my weekend trying to rebuild the bootloader from source code.
Why? That's going to be a big question. Why?
Well, I tried using the binary that was provided, but the binary of the bootloader requires you to press the power button to turn the device on, and for some reason now the power button doesn't work.
So you have to do the whole thing from scratch.
Yeah, this whole thing, repairing this NAS, has turned into a massive there's a hole in my bucket.
Oh, man. All right. Anyways, so for this on this episode of Nerds Amalgamated, we'll be talking about TikTok banning. TikTok ban now affecting gaming, cryonic brains, the next evolution to brains in a jar, and why do Marvel movies suck? Professor, you've got a story about the TikTok ban and how it's affecting gaming.
Well, I expect you've probably heard about the US banning TikTok and giving them 9 months to sell it to a US company.
Hallelujah, the Lord has spoken. Thank God the TikTok ban has come.
Someone else will just replace them.
Yeah.
Everybody has short videos now.
Yeah, but at least TikTok won't be as bad as it was. You know how every TikTok video will be either someone dancing, someone eating copious amounts of food, or someone saying "buy my item" using this affiliate marketing link that everyone will use eventually, or somewhat.
Yeah, I've seen those exact same sort of videos come up on Facebook and YouTube. So.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
I don't think this is going to be a big change to the type of content people consume.
Yeah, but the payment
it's just going to shift them around.
Yeah, but the payment scale with TikTok, I think it'd be pretty different to the other social media companies, if I recall.
What do you mean?
If I recall, I think TikTok pays more.
Okay.
Yeah, than other social media companies, but I could be dead wrong on that one.
Also, this is only going to happen in the US, so most of the rest of the world hasn't banned TikTok.
I've heard stories that India has also did the whole TikTok ban as well.
Yeah, India is not on great terms with China, so they ban a lot of stuff China does.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is actually an example from the article that a few years ago when PUBG Mobile came out, they banned it because it was made by a Chinese contractor.
I remember that, and a lot of people were mad about it.
So, how will this affect games? The law does have a requirement that the president can force the sale under threat of a ban for companies that have the criteria more than a million monthly active users for at least two of the past 3 months. The company is based in a foreign adversary country or parties based in such countries directly or indirectly own a 20% stake in the company. And the company makes a website or application that lets you make or share text, images, video, real-time communications, or other such content.
So basically, the country that's banning the the games, for example, they have to have a say in it as well, essentially.
No, I don't know where you're getting that from.
My mistake. Sorry.
If your app is big enough and it lets people share user-made content, including voice chat,
yeah,
and it's based in a foreign adversary country, or 20% of the company is owned by a foreign adversary country,
yeah,
then they can be banned by the US government. Well, that's brought up some big questions, because 40% of Epic Games was purchased by Tencent in 2012.
Oh.
Apparently, there's been an update to the article since I first read it, and now Tencent owns about 35% of Epic.
Oh, that's 5%, man.
That's not... still 15% more than the threshold.
Ah, okay. Fair enough.
And Fortnite has plenty of users. Unreal Engine itself has about 750,000 active users. So eventually, we might have to see Epic Games divest the Unreal Engine and Fortnite, because they're partially owned by a Chinese company.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that. They said that. I've seen really articles when they're saying it's the law's definition for qualified divestiture. Yeah, for it. Do you know the definition of it? Oh, I'm not familiar with that term.
Let's take a look on the internet. I Google qualified divestiture, and yeah, all the results are just the text of this new law.
There is an article I'm looking at. It's called from the website called Find Law, and it's saying, what is divestiture? It is divestiture occurs in many reasons and has many forms. In general, it involves selling, closing, or redistributing business assets. Not all apply to small businesses, but a small business may result from a larger company divesting its assets. So it can be a spin-off, which is a larger company creating a new business, existing division remains part of the parent company. Split-off, the parent company completely divests itself from a new company and shareholders have no shares in the old company. It is split off. Sell-off, the company sells off all of its assets for cash. And carve-out, which is create a full subsidiary from its core business. For instance, a multinational corporation may create a wholly owned subsidiary in another country so that shareholders in that country can own the company's assets. That's one way of putting it.
Okay, so basically they have to sell the part of the company that wants to do business in the US.
Yeah.
A Epic representative has said that if the law applied to them, Tencent would have to sell 15% of their shares, so they would have no plan to break up Epic. The other bigger issue is Riot Games, 100% owned by Tencent.
Oh, shit. And their biggest market is America with the League of Legends game. Well, one of their biggest markets.
So it's entirely possible that Tencent will have to sell Riot, or Riot will have to shut down League of Legends in the US.
Oh, no. No.
Yeah, come on, people. There are better games you could be wasting your life playing.
Are you sure you want to... Okay, I got a question for you, American government. Are you sure you want to ban League of Legends? Come on now. Are you sure you want to do that?
This just reminds me of that meme. They targeted gamers.
And what was the end result of that? But that's insane. Can you imagine banning a big, big game in America?
And I can see it happening quite easily.
And plus, this is like think of the revenue they'll be losing from this, and the amount and the number of tournaments that will probably disappear because of League of Legends being banned in America. I think I stunned the professor.
I'm just trying to find a source.
Fair enough.
So I'm having trouble finding a source, but I was trying to find out where... Oh, no, here it is.
Yeah?
The most players... The country with the most league players is China.
Okay, fair.
Followed by Korea, Western Europe, then North America. So they'd be losing 27 million in North America. That probably also includes Canada and Mexico. Unless Mexico is counted under Latin America North. It depends how they break down their statistics here. So that's a lot of people, but they also have so many more people in China that it's not, you know, it's not even funny. They have 75 million people playing in China out of 130 million players.
Damn.
So I wouldn't expect Riot to care too much if they got banned.
Yeah, but how they...
They wouldn't be happy. They'd fight it. But in the end, they wouldn't go around making a big deal to satisfy the US government.
But how would the players' base react to it, though? I mean, if I was a really big League of Legends player and in America and I saw this, I would be losing my mind going, what the hell is this? Why are you doing this? Why? I mean,
they'd probably find another game to play pretty quickly.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, no other game is as competitive as League of Legends. Let's put it down there. No really? Game is.
Even the only game in its genre anymore. There's Dota, Heroes of the Storm, all of these other games that are just exactly the same gameplay.
I get that, but okay, closest competitive game to League of Legends would be Dota. Heroes of the Storm? I mean, yeah, not many people play it from what I recall. Well, like, that's it. That's all I know. It's either Dota or Heroes of the Storm. But no one has that reach like League of Legends. But continuing on though, with this ban. So what other games will be affected by this besides League of Legends and Fortnite?
Well, the Committee for Foreign Investment in the United States has had some investigations through Tencent's purchases of other companies like Sumo, which is a bit weird because Sumo is a UK company. So it's a Chinese company buying a UK company, and the US is getting in their face and being like, what are you doing?
Yes.
So basically we're looking at any Chinese, partially Chinese-owned game or wholly Chinese-owned game with more than 1 million monthly players and 20% Chinese-owned stake.
I just read a line on the article. They said even Genshin Impact might be affected. Genshin.
The thing I was more worried about was the Epic issue, because Epic owns Unreal.
Yeah.
If there did end up being a massive divestiture of Unreal or so on, that would be a huge impact on game developers, because Unreal is one of the more popular engines out there.
And that being said, though, from a game developer's perspective, having this type of laws being put on you from a game developer perspective must be worrying in terms of, wow, the government is really hampering on the games that I make, and if it turns up and if it affects my bottom line, I'm going to be really screwed.
Well, personally, that doesn't worry me because I don't use Unreal.
Okay.
I actually use Godot for most of my work. But I'm just an indie developer, so who knows what I'm doing, you know? I'm one person doing what I do, slowly and surely. Maybe one day I will eventually release a game. Well, technically I've already released a game, actually. I made that one in uni that was released, but I haven't released anything since then. But really, it's not about the type of games that I'm allowed to make here.
Yeah.
It's about the technology that I'm allowed to work with and who I'm allowed to sell it to.
Yeah.
China is a humongous market.
Yeah.
And it's hard to break into China because of their own rules. So this is sort of feels like the West reacting to China's rules. China has their own rules about games being released by Chinese publishers. If you want to sell your game in China, you need to publish through an approved company that is owned by Chinese people.
Makes sense, yeah. That makes sense. But you reckon what America is doing in terms of banning certain games from other countries and stuff, you reckon they're doing it in a good way or a bad way? Like, you reckon it's a good move or it's a bad move, from your opinion?
That gets into all sorts of geopolitics that I'm just not comfortable making a statement on. On one hand, I think, yes, treat China the same way they're treating the Western companies, because China likes to rip off Western developers and not, like, it's really hard to stop Chinese pirates, and there are even Chinese developers who will pirate a game and resell it in China.
Yeah.
Sort of bootlegging a game. And there's basically nothing you can do about that. So on one hand, I think, yeah, this is treat them the way they're treating us. On the other hand, it just feels like getting in the way of the global market.
Yeah.
And having cultural cross-pollination like that is a, I think it's a big thing to stopping you being able to dehumanize in other people from other countries. We're starting to see some Chinese movies and TV series and books and stuff come over to the West.
Yeah.
But think of the difference between China and Japan. Everybody loves Japan because of anime.
Yep.
And everybody hates China because that's what they don't have the same cultural... tolerance. Cultural diplomacy is the term I'm looking
for. Ah, right, yeah. Makes sense, yeah. But I think, I say something. Yeah, I agree with you there.
So I think it's probably not a good thing for reducing global tension and preventing war, but who knows? I'm not an expert in geopolitics.
Fair enough. I mean, from a player's perspective, trying to... With America doing this, I'll be raging a lot, because not only because my favorite game will be banned, but it's also the fact that competition will also be will not be the same as well. And not to mention you're gonna with this ban, you might see a high number of people going to VPNs as well in the near future.
Using VPNs to access TikTok?
Not only TikTok, maybe accessing Riot Games as well, and Fortnite.
Well, using a VPN for gaming isn't really a good idea because it massively increases the amount of lag. So it's really not good for competitive games like League of Legends.
Yeah.
But I could see people in the West using VPNs to access TikTok if bans like this go through. On the other hand, is the demographic that uses TikTok really the sort of demographic who would be bothered to learn how a VPN works?
I mean, they can learn quick. I will give them that. They can learn quick.
They can. And maybe this would be the impetus for them to learn how to use a computer. But look, I was trying to do repair on a Xbox controller recently.
Yeah.
And I was looking up videos showing how to do it. I was having a bit of trouble with one of the steps, so I decided to dig into it deeper, and specifically I was having trouble with calibration. They make it really hard to calibrate the controllers. Luckily, I found a way around that. I'm not going to go into detail here because it's off topic, but I even ended up watching a few TikTok videos on it. I don't normally use TikTok, and I ended up watching a couple of TikTok videos on controller repair to see if they had any clues on how to do a calibration.
How'd it go?
Well, all the comments were stuff like, bro, just buy a new controller in Zoomer speak.
Did you try Reddit?
I tried Reddit.
What was their response?
Reddit had a far better take on it, talking about how to actually do the repair. But every comment on this video was some variation of just buy a new controller, just in Zoomer speak. And I'm like, okay. Does nobody in this generation care about repairability and right to repair?
Nope. This is the point where you go, we're not going to fix anything. Fixing is just not our thing anymore.
Look, if this is the future of the right to repair movement, we've lost.
Who's that guy that's forefronting the right to repair movement again?
Lewis Rossman.
Yep. I wonder how Lewis is looking into this at this point. Was we going, what have I done? No, I mean, no shade. I'm not going to throw shade at Lewis. I think Lewis is what Lewis is doing is a good thing, but I'm not sure whether it's going to work in the next generation or two. So I'll admire him for that.
So anyway, my point is, I'm not sure the Zoomers care enough about technology to learn how a V-Bucks.
I'm indifferent on this one, but I see where you're coming from now that you said that experience. But that being said, though, like I said, how about if they... what if they went through the bootleg site edition? Will that aggravate the situation, or will that ease the situation, let's say?
What do you mean by bootleg site? Do you mean a site that rehosts
TikTok? Yeah.
Well, there are sites that rehost YouTube, so wouldn't entirely surprise me.
But for gaming? Okay, what were for gaming?
I'm not sure, because the Chinese bootleggers who steal games and sell them in China are doing it to make money.
Yeah.
And the margins on rehosting TikTok videos are probably not great.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at this point, it on the one hand, while it sounds like a good idea, on the other hand, it the consequences is going to be very massive and very dire for gamers.
Yeah, I think it would go out of our wheelhouse to really talk about it, but this article that is in the show notes for this topic from gamesindustry.biz has some really interesting details about the law and what sort of companies it affects.
Hmm.
So if you're interested in that, I reckon you should check it out, because the law does have some weird, interesting bits, like exceptions based on what the app is used for rather than what the information it tracks and gives access to. So it does feel like one of those laws where the government doesn't quite understand what they're doing, because there are other alternatives for China to get this information. So we'll see what happens in 9 months, because there's a 9-month period before the ban comes into play.
Oh boy.
So yeah, see you in 9 months.
9 months and counting. Oh boy. And it's when after 9 months, it will be all your account. Oh, I was gonna go like, it will be as bad as frozen brains.
Okay, terrible segue.
That's what I'll be remembered for in the end. So we were so this is an interesting article about the evolution to brains in a jar. Cryonic brains. Story is basically in 2014, which is basically December, mind you, Dr. Stephen Coles, a UCLA professor who studied aging, passed away from pancreatic cancer. And for many years, Coles made his home in LA. He chose to enter hospice care in Scottsdale, Arizona. That way, he could be close to a team of doctors who would remove and freeze his brain when he died. That's a very weird way to go.
Yeah, the whole point being that eventually they'll be able to figure out a way to bring you back to life.
Mm. And the procedure is very interesting as well. So they restored his breathing and circulation with a heart-lung resuscitator known as a thumper, a mechanical device used in emergency medicine to perform CPR, and injected his body with anticoagulants to keep the blood flowing. And all of this was done to protect the brain from damage that could occur after too long without oxygen. Next, the body was cooled in an ice water bath and blood replaced with an organ preservation solution. And then the body would arrive at its final destination, and no, it's not heaven. It's Alcor, the nation's oldest provider of cryonics, the freezing of human corpses and brains in liquid nitrogen that will one day, technology willing, live again. So this is an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, just abandon your entire body, because it's going to be easier to grow you a new one if they ever figure out how to bring you back to life.
Okay, is this... Okay, remember how we were talking about brains in a jar?
Yep.
Okay.
You can put a brain in a jar and hook it up to a artificial perfusion device and keep it alive and functioning normally for a long period.
Yeah. Is this better or is this worse?
Well, in this case, you're dead, so there's no sensations.
Yeah.
And we hypothesized in previous episode about the brain in the jar that a brain without its normal attachments would be subjected to incredible torture. So I think if I was going to be preserved until they could grow me a new body, at the moment, I prefer to have my brain frozen.
Okay.
If they were going to perform a transplant or something short term, I'd prefer to be kept in a jar. But not too long, because I don't want to go crazy from the torture of not having any senses.
Yeah, can you imagine waking up, be like, wait a minute, this is not my body? And then jumping and then going crazy over that. So this happened. So Cole's death happened in 2014. Now, 10 years later, according to Emile Kendi-Zoria, MD, CEO of Tomorrow Bio, a German biotech firm that specializes in human cryopreservation, stated brain removal is not a big issue and becoming more popular among the interest in cryonics. Storing a brain is faster, cheaper, and despite the human taboo of decapitation, posed for a higher degree of social acceptance, Kendi-Zoria says. I'm butchering the names here, so...
Kendi-Zoria.
Thank you. Kendi-Zoria. Since anatomy departments and research institutions have been storing brains for years, but what about the rest of the body? Won't future humans need their legs and arms when they wake up from their cryo suspension? Kendi-Zoria answered, while the brain is unique and it cannot be recreated, the fundamental logic is that all the rest of the body can be recreated. This means by the time technology exists to cure death and reanimate the human brain, slapping together a real and virtual vessel would be a cinch. This is going to be a whole lot interesting. I think from what I'm seeing, I reckon what's going to happen, you're going to see something similar to video games in terms of, okay, preserve the brain chip and then bring it back to us, and then we'll create the human body again and again and again and again.
I think that would only work a couple of times, because every time you die, your brain would take a little bit of damage. Although, if they're capable of growing you a whole new body, they can probably repair most of that damage.
Yeah.
One of the big questions I've always had about cryon is, who's going to actually bring you back to life?
Ooh.
Like, your brain stored for 100 years in a jar. 100 years from now, who's going to care about you enough to bring you back to life?
I mean, if it was like after a big massive war, and society has got like an arc of human bodies, and it's now safe to come out now, essentially, maybe they'll bring it back.
If there was some sort of war that wiped out most of humanity, the kind of technology you need to bring back a brain from the dead would not be
fair. Maybe. They said here, well, these ideas are far-fetched. Dr. Kendi-Zoria is quick to point out that there was a time in the past where heart transplantations, taking one heart and connecting to another body, sounded pretty scientific as well. But as neuropreservation grows in popularity, the question remains, what will we do with all these frozen brains in the future? So Kendi-Zoria, he's a trained medical doctor turned cryonics evangelist. He was a former cancer researcher. He was frustrated by the agonizingly slow pace of progress and never found it acceptable to tell a 25-year-old that they have an incurable cancer and they're going to die, he says. I think that everybody should live as long as they choose to. And there is a hope behind cryonics is that eventually very smart people using technology that hasn't been invented yet will figure out how to conquer death. And for anyone with that untreatable disease or anyone who would like to live beyond their average lifespan to elongate their lives, they just need to freeze themselves and then wait for those smart and hopefully benevolent people to wake us up. I think that kind of answers your question, doesn't it, Professor?
Yep.
It's like, who's benevolent enough to do this?
And there are some other issues with this.
Okay.
I've linked an article in the show notes. If there's any sort of failure of the cryonics any time in the next however many years it takes to bring people back to life, and we know this because it's already happened, and cryonics has only been around for 70 years or something.
Yeah.
If you thaw out, you're basically screwed. Your body's going to rot anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So you need to find someone who will keep your body in an acceptable condition for the next however many hundred years, bring you back when the technology is developed, and then how are you going to go back to your life? everything you had will have been inherited and passed on to your children and so on.
Yeah.
What is left for you? You're in a completely new world, which it would be exciting, but everyone you know is probably dead. You have nothing to your name. How do you get by?
Yeah, I mean, Futurama kind of answered that question. Remember? Remember when Fry came out of the tube?
Yep.
And how
they had the reintegration process.
And how he was given the delivery chip. But you're right. You're right though, in terms of how it will take a long, long time. It will, everything you know is gone. The other problem you'll have to deal with, not only the everything you know be gone, is also the fact that these things are not cheap.
Yeah. So when the money runs out, who's going to keep you frozen?
Oh yeah, and when you look further in this article, they said if you want a full body suspension, tomorrow buyer will charge it for $200,000.
And that's assuming they actually look after you properly and they don't deliberately let you fall out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because who's going to sue them? You can't. You're dead.
Yeah, and your family might. And if you do it with your family's consent, that would be a costly. That would be an even more costly legal battle. And then Dr. Kenziora says that at the bargain price of 75,000 euros, brain-only cryopreservation is an attractive option for those hoping to extend their time on Earth. By the way, the tomorrow buyers, their price is 200,000 euros, by the way, not $200,000. Convert that to current pricing now.
So it's less than half the amount if you want to just keep your brain.
So if you want to convert 200,000 euros to Australian, it would be 325,802.26. Yeah, that's your full body, by the way. But let's see how much would it cost for brain preservation. Oh, $122,175.85. So is it worth it? Will it be worth it?
I don't have that kind of money.
I don't have that kind of money either.
But how long do they guarantee they will keep?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here's a thought, Professor. Bear with me here. Can you imagine infomercials, maybe 10 or 20 years from now, saying like this, you, the humble viewer, can get your brain frozen for a cheap price of $1,000. All you need to do is pay a gratuity insurance fee of $2,000, and you can have your brain frozen and let store for a lifetime guarantee. Can you imagine infomercials like that in the near future?
Yep.
And here's another, and here I thought of an interesting idea. In another way, they could help recreate the body. Use nanotechnology in terms of if the body is thawing, maybe the nanobots could help accelerate the healing process, for example.
That's just a sci-fi buzzword you've shoved in there at the moment.
I know. I just wanted to bring some hope in this, but damn it. But it's an idea, though, nonetheless.
Lots of things are ideas, and they never happen.
Yeah, that's true. but at least they're more fanciful than Marvel movies. Okay, that has to be a better segue than that. Come on. You gotta give me that one.
At least if your brain's frozen, you don't have to watch Marvel movies.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, with the Marvel movies, recently Joe and Anthony Russo have been speaking on Games Radar Plus, and they've come up with some very interesting takes. They said basically, in relation to the changes in how people absorb media, they said it's a Hollywood-wide issue and not a Marvel one. And they say, and I quote, "I think it's a reflection of the current state of everything. It's difficult right now. It's an interesting time. I think we're in a transitional people, and people don't know quite yet how they're going to receive stories moving forward and what kind of stories they want." I mean, I kind of agree that in terms of there is a transitional period.
So if we're in a transition period and we don't know what we want to see, why do they keep showing us the same thing we've already shown we don't want to see?
I have no idea. And they continued by saying, there is a big generational gap about how you consume media. Really? Really?
There is. My parents wouldn't binge.
I mean, people still go to movies, like, even if they're young or old, like, people still go to it. Like, the cinemas are still running. Like, when was a lot... Like, I haven't seen cinemas
for
going...
For now, maybe,
but the whole idea of let's go to the cinemas and watch something is still a thing. He continues by saying there's a generation that used to appointment viewing and going to a theater on a certain date to see something, but that's aging out. Meanwhile, the new generations are, I want it now, I want to process it now. They're moving on to the next thing, which they process it whilst doing two other things at the same time. You know, it's a very different moment in time than it's ever been. So I think...
So he's seen those TikTok videos where they have the thing and then the other thing and then the Subway Surfers gameplay.
Yeah. And he goes by saying, I think everyone, including Marvel, is experiencing the same thing. This transition. And I think that really is probably what's at play more than anything else. One is not like the other, though. Like, people will still go and watch a movie. Like, it may not be a generational thing. It may be also that the movie that you're showing, it could be boring as hell.
Well, I'm sure the Russo brothers have lots of experience making boring movies.
Joe Russo noted the new generation of moviegoers communicate largely through memes and headlines with nobody reading past 10 sentences, so everything's 100 characters or less, or 10-second videos on social media you swipe through. You're part of the new generation, right, Professor?
I'm a millennial.
Really? I always thought you were a Gen Z-er.
No, I'm a millennial.
All right. Okay. You reckon that's... I get the whole, like, communicating through memes, but the headlines and nobody reading past 2 sentences and so 100 characters or less, I think that's kind of like, I don't think it's true. I think it's for a certain group of people, but I think a majority would still read past the 2 sentences. Some of the other quotes from Anthony Russo says that the superhero fatigue has nothing to do with superheroes in particular. It's just fatigue in general. The superhero fatigue question was long ago before the work we were doing, Anthony continued. So it's sort of like the eternal complaint. Like, we always used to cite this back in our early days with our superhero work. People used to complain about Westerns in the same way, but they lasted for decades and decades and decades. They were continually reinvented and brought into new heights as they went on. I mean, but the problem with the superhero fatigue is that the stories that you see in superhero movies, they're adapting. It do not appeal to the new generation.
Maybe what needs to happen is superhero movies need to be reinvented, like the Westerns he just spoke about.
Their version of reinventing is basically, oh, let's deconstruct the superheroes and choose characters that mainstream audiences have no idea existed.
Well, that worked very well for them for the first few years.
Yeah, and now, like, when was the last time you ever go down and say, bruh, you know what I want to watch? I want to watch that new Ms. Marvel show on Disney+. Like, Really? Like, have you ever heard anyone say that? Or have you ever heard anyone say, you know what I want to watch? I want to watch that new Eternals movie. That was a great movie. Like, have you ever heard anyone say that? Or my personal favorite, hey, let's watch She-Hulk. Says no one ever. Like, there's this implication, like, as soon as Phase 3 ended, all the OG fans died away and Generation Z appeared out of thin air. Like, no, that's not what happened. People just got tired of the new content.
So that's superhero fatigue.
It's not only the superhero fatigue, but it's just the way superhero movies are made now. It's the reason why there's the quote-unquote superhero fatigue. Like, it's not just a writing problem. It's also an ideological problem as well.
What, you think people don't like having a Goody Two Shoes character?
No, what I don't like is when you have, like, when you have characters do the whole, like, oh, there's no such thing as a good guy or a bad guy anymore. Everybody is a piece of shit.
So you don't like morally gray protagonists?
It's becoming too... It used to be hip back in the day, but now it's just everybody's doing it, you know?
So they need to reinvent themselves.
Yeah, essentially, yeah, like,
and we've come full circle.
Like, tumbling and falling right here. Like, make more movies with the old Marvel movies, the people that created the Marvel movies, like Iron Man or Captain America or Thor. Even the Thor movies were just the recent Thor movies. They were poorly received because nobody wants to watch them.
Or were they poorly received because the actors themselves have admitted they didn't do their best work?
Yeah, exactly. Like Chris Hemsworth was saying, like how, my iteration of Thor was just bad, as I recall. But they should be just more like action. There should be more action. There should be more. More of the good guys versus bad guys. No more of the whole. I'm so morally conflicted. And so here we go. Like, what was he said? The actor admitted on GQ last year that the fourth standalone was too silly for its own good, but the misstep continued to haunt him. I got caught in the improv and the wackiness, and I did a parody of myself. I didn't stick to the landing. Yeah, sometimes I felt like a security guard for the team. I would read everyone else's lines and go, oh, they got way cooler stuff and they're having more fun. What's my character doing? It's all about, you got a wig on, you got the muscles, you got the costume, where's the lighting? Yeah, I'm part of this big thing, but I'm probably pretty replaceable. I mean, that sucks. And the other problem is with Marvel movies, I don't know whether you've seen this as well, is that all the people that do the writing, that do the directing as well, they don't know squat about the comics themselves, and that really sucks as well. But an interesting thing though, one of the other actors, he says that perhaps this is a good thing. He quotes, "It's an interesting moment where everybody has to go, okay, what now? Hopefully, from that somebody." Somebody either breathes new life into comic book movies or something else blossoms, which is not superheroes. And I think there'll be some good ones yet to come, but I think it's kind of a welcome moment. What do you reckon, Professor? What do you reckon will come next after superheroes?
I don't know. I'm too out of touch.
I actually saw a video related to this and someone replied, video game movies.
Yeah, those are sort of popular at the moment. And we've had a couple of good ones, finally.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, the Mario movie, the Sonic movies, they've been good. They've been good. But here's the thing, though. The fan bases for video game movies are as heated as the superhero movie. Like, can you imagine video game video game movies and the level of comments you see on Facebook or social media, for example, in general, saying like, okay, this movie did not do this character justice. Okay, why is this character not acting like the characters in the game, for example, you know?
That happens for any adaptation.
Yeah, I guess so, but you're gonna get like Hollywood will mess it up. The same with video. Same with superhero movies. Hollywood will mess it up as well with the video game movies. Even though we have some success, there's gonna be a lot of mess involved in when it comes to video game movies.
Okay, if you say so.
Fair enough. Okay, on to our shoutouts. On the 2nd of May 1952, the Havilland Comet makes the first jetliner flight with fare-paying passengers from London to Johannesburg. So on the 2nd of May 1952 at 15:12 GMT, the British Overseas Airways Corporation, the Havilland DH-106 Comet 1G ALYP, departed London for Johannesburg, South Africa, with 36 passengers and a crew of 7. The approximate 7,000 miles, 11,265 kilometers, flight was expected to take 23 hours, 40 minutes, with intermediate stops at Rome, Beirut, Khartoum, Entebbe, and Livingston. With the crew changes at Beirut and Khartoum, BOAC's chairman, Sir Miles Thomas, joined the flight at Livingston for the final stage. This was the first commercial jetliner, and its introduction had revolutionized the industry. Each passenger on this historic flight will receive a special first flight certificate signed by the pilot of the first part of the flight, Captain A.M. Majendie. And the single fare cost was £175 and a return of £315. The same price as for BOAC's pistol engine aircraft. Wow, that's cheap.
Probably sounds cheaper than it was. I think flying has actually gotten cheaper.
You mean now? No. Yeah. I respect.
Compare the inflation though.
Okay. Like, let's say, for example, you want to see if you want to compare the flight. So same flight, England to Johannesburg, flight prices. So Egypt Air right now, connecting $1,030. Etihad Airlines, $1,119. Virgin Atlantic nonstop, $1,339, and British Airways, $1,436. And this is for today, mind you, on the 17th. So I don't know. I mean, maybe you might be right. Like, flying might be cheaper, but yeah, like with the inflation and all, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I'm just trying to find a inflation calculator for pounds.
Ah, fair enough. So this plane, the DH-106 Comet, was the first production airplane and was very similar to the two prototypes. It can be visually identified by its square passenger windows. And this plane was flown by a pilot, co-pilot, flight engineer, and navigator, and can carry up to 44 passengers.
Yeah, so the £175,
yeah,
counting for inflation from the Bank of England inflation calculator,
yep,
would cost in March 2024,
yep,
£4,222.
Oh, that's a kick in the teeth.
Yeah, and that's pounds. So converting that into dollars.
Yep.
I'm assuming the prices you quoted earlier were in all.
Yeah.
Just over 8,000 odd.
Oh.
So flying has gotten significantly cheaper.
I guess.
And significantly faster.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
Because this flight took almost 24 hours and had to stop, what's that, 5 times.
Yeah, it's true. And now it's just one or two stops, that's it. And non-stop. Yeah. You got a point there, yeah.
Now, they probably had more legroom back then.
But this plane was powered by 4 Havilland jet engines, and it was a single-shaft centrifugal turbojet with a single-stage compressor, 10 combustible chambers, and a single-stage turbine as well. A complete overhaul was required every 375 hours, and the Ghost was the first turbojet certified for civil airline operations. On May the 2nd, 2024, the 10th anniversary of The Amazing Spider-Man 2. The Amazing Spider-Man 2, internationally titled The Amazing Spider-Man 2 Rise of Electro, was a 2014 American superhero film based on the Marvel Comics character Superman, produced by Columbia Pictures in association with Marvel Entertainment, Arad Productions Incorporated, Matt Tomac Productions, and Ingenious Film Partners, and distributed by Sony Pictures Releasing. The film was directed by Mark Webb from a screenplay by Alex Kurtzman, Roberto Orci, and Jeff Pinkner, based on the story conceived by the three alongside James Vanderbilt. This is the fifth theatrical Spider-Man film, the sequel to The Amazing Spider-Man 2012, and the final film of The Amazing Spider-Man series. Andrew Garfield was Peter Parker, Emma Stone, Jamie Foxx, Dan Heaton, Campbell Scott, and Paul Giamatti and Sally Field. In the film, Peter Parker tried to protect his girlfriend Gwen Stacy as he investigates his parents' deaths, along with dealing with the supervillain Electro and the return of his best friend Harry Osborn, who was dying from a deadly genetic disease. This was the first Spider-Man film to be filmed entirely in New York and the largest film production ever in New York City. While filming Peter and Gwen's first reunion after their breakup, Andrew Garfield's heel was run over by a taxi.
Ouch.
Hateful. This was the first Spider-Man film to not feature any new footage of Uncle Ben. He does appear in the film, but only in stock footage in the beginning, taken from The Amazing Spider-Man 2012. And what would be a Spider-Man movie but without J. Jonah Jameson? The humorously hateful news boss J. Jonah Jameson, one of the most iconic characters in Spider-Man mythos, was never mentioned in The Amazing Spider-Man 2012. In this sequel, he is spoken of frequently but never appears. The producers claimed they could not find an actor to measure up to J.K. Simmons' legendary portrayal of this character in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man films. Stan Lee, the writer who came up with the idea of these characters, make cameo appearances in all the films, has often said he would volunteer to play Jameson if he, the director, was the director was 30 or 40 years younger.
You mean if Stan Lee was younger?
Oh, right. My bad. If Stan Lee was 30 or 40 years younger. Ironically, when casting Spider-Man Far From Home, they could still think of no one better than Simmons. So he resumed his role as Jameson.
J.K. Simmons is a legend.
I know. Also, both Garfield and Felicity Jones have starred in Doctor Who 2005. Reese Ifrance, the villain of the preceding installment, The Amazing Spider-Man 2012, was considered to play the 11th Doctor, a role which eventually went to Garfield's close friend, Matt Smith. On May the 5th, 2024, this was the 35th anniversary for Field of Dreams. This was a 1989 sports fantasy film written and directed by Phil Aidan Robinson, based on Canadian novelist W.P. Kinsella's 1982 novel Shoeless Joe. The film stars Kevin Costner as a farmer who builds a baseball field in his cornfield that attracts the ghosts of baseball legends, including Shoeless Joe Jackson, played by Ray Liotta, and the Chicago Black Sox. Amy Madigan, James Earl Jones, and Burt Lancaster in his final film role also stars. And this is the movie that's famous for the quote, "You build it, he will come. You build it, he will come." So the film was shot using the novel's title. Eventually, an executive decision was made to rename Field of Dreams. Robinson did not like the name, saying he loved Shoeless Joe and the new title was better suited for one about dreams deferred. Kinsella told Robinson after the fact that his original title for the book had been The Dream Field and that publisher had imposed the title Shoeless Joe. After filming was completed, the family that owned the farm kept the field and added a small hut with inexpensive souvenirs for sale. As of 2018, visitors were free to come to the field and play baseball as they pleased between April and November. After the movie was completed, test audiences didn't like the original film Shoeless Joe Jackson because it sounded like a movie about a bum or a hobo. Universal called director and writer Phil Aidan Robinson and told him that Shoeless Joe didn't work and that the they changed the title Field of Dreams. When Robinson heard the news of the change, he called the author and told him the bad news. But apparently he didn't care, saying that Shoeless Joe was the title the publishing company gave. Then unknown Ben Affleck and Matt Damon were among the thousands of extras in the Fenway Park scene and are uncredited. Over a decade later, when the director welcomed Affleck onto the set of The Sum of All Fears, Affleck stated, "Nice working with you again." Robinson asked, "What do you mean, again?" And Affleck explained the connection. You can enter 42 degrees by 29 by 51.8 degree north. I'm reading the coordinates badly, by the way.
Yeah, right? It's 42 degrees, 21 minutes, 51.8 seconds north. 91 degrees, 3 minutes, and 18.4 seconds west. If you have trouble reading a map, always ask a scout for help.
Thank you. If you put these coordinates into Google Maps for the location of the field, built for the film. And despite his character delivering the movie's signature speech, Brazing Baseball, in real life, James Earl Jones isn't a fan of the sport. Despite this, he would play another baseball enthusiast 4 years later in The Sandlot. And the famous line, "If you build it, he will come," was featured in the Daily Telegraph, the UK edition, article on the 10 most misquoted film phrases. Is often misquoted as, "If you build it, they will come," which I took the misfortune of saying that before this show. And on to our messed up moment in nerddom number 12. What is the messed up moment this time, Professor?
Well, I thought I'd start with your birth.
Yep. That was a messed up moment.
Have you ever heard of the Davy Crockett nuclear device?
No, I haven't. I've not heard that one.
Well, I know you're a Fallout fan, so this might ring a bell. You know the Fat Man?
Vaguely.
It's a handheld nuclear weapon, launches a nuclear projectile.
Yeah, the Fat Man, yeah, that was in Nagasaki, yeah.
No, in the Fallout games. You've played Fallout, how do you not know what a Fat Man is?
It's been a while since...
named after the Nagasaki.
I have heard of the Fat Man of the World War II thing, but not the Fat Man of Fallout. It's been a while, but humor me, yes, humor me on that one.
So you take that and you scale it up a little bit, so it's still man-portable by a squad of two or three people.
Uh-huh.
And you design it to kill Soviets.
Oh, no!
During the Cold War, in the 1950s and 60s,
yeah,
the US Army developed a nuclear weapon called the Davy Crockett, which was a nuclear recoilless gun, basically a nuclear rocket launcher. And the idea was you'd be close enough to fire this thing at enemy tanks, which would crossing the Fulda Gap. If the Russians ever rolled over Germany, these were supposed to stop them.
Okay, I'm curious to ask. Was the person firing the weapon, was there any chance of surviving it, or...?
Surprisingly, yes.
What?
The nuclear round, the M388, had a yield of 20 tons of TNT, so it's very small compared to what you'd expect.
I mean, goddamn, imagine this with an actual nuke, it would just...
It would make a mess.
Yeah. A mess is an understatement. It would just make a big hole. But for this one, though, so there'll be no fallout, though? Like, no nuclear fallout with this?
Oh, there would be lots of fallout.
Oh,
because
boy.
It's an explosion at ground level, or just above ground level, which is what causes the worst fallout.
Oh, boy. So what's the messed up part in this whole gun?
Oh, can you imagine being the guy tasked with launching this? Sure, you're technically far enough away, but you are also using a nuclear device that is that close to you.
Oh, yeah. That's the messed up part. Yep. Yeah, I can see that.
And it also could have been the kickoff for World War III and absolute total annihilation with a full scale nuclear war.
Oh yeah. Oh yes, see that now. Yep. Yeah, I'm seeing the shell's greatest effect would have been the extreme prompt neutron radiation, which would have killed most of the troops inside that circle within minutes. It would do very little, if any, damage to the enemy's tracked vehicle. Troops further away would have died within hours, days, and less than 2 weeks. Yep.
And dying of perhaps the worst place to be in a nuclear war is not too close to the bomb because you get instantly killed.
Yep.
And not too far away that you're safe, but just close enough that you die a few weeks later because it is not a good way to go.
Oh, yeah. Radiation burns. Yep.
But here's the description of the standard for the crew to follow when firing the Davy Crockett. They advise soldiers to shelter behind a sloped hill and lie in prone position with their head and neck covered. So you're still close enough that they're telling you to lie down and cover your head. And you're not close enough that they're telling you to bend over and kiss your ass goodbye. So you got that going for you.
And I like how this is a 5-man crew as well. So it's got a commander, a gunner, assistant gunner, a loader, and a computer.
Yeah, there would be a guy who was good at maths there who would calculate the range and firing angle.
Yep. Oh, the spending of it as well. I'm looking at the spending. They said this is a $20 million operation. So that's equivalent to $199 million in 2023 standards. And... Yeah, that's a lot of money.
It's just wild that there was ever a point when they were like, yeah, let's fire nukes that are just big enough that we're just outside the deadly range.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, man. All right, anyways, so on to our wacky movies. And since it's Star Wars weekend, May the 4th, I've got a wacky movie for you. And it is on the 2nd of May 1985 in Australia, Star Wars, The Ewok Adventure, Caravan of Courage, was enjoyed its theatrical release, and it was directed by John Corti. The sci-fi feature starred Warwick Davis and Eric Walker, and here is the summary. Wicket the Ewok and his friends agree to help two shipwrecked human children, Mace and Sindel, on a quest to find their parents. This film was given a limited international theatrical run, for which was retitled Caravan of Courage, an Ewok Adventure. It followed the sequel, Ewoks, The Battle of Endor, in 1985. George Lucas had allowed the Star Wars universe to be produced for television in 1978 with the Star Wars Holiday Special, which proved to be an embarrassment. Lucas assumed greater control over the planned half-hour TV project about Ewoks. He hired Thomas G. Smith to produce the film after Smith had stepped down as the manager of Industrial Light and Magic, ILM, following his work on Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Lucas also hired Bob Carrow, a personal assistant, to co-write the story with him. Both Ewok films were some of the last intensive stop-motion animation work ILM produced, as by the early 1980s, the technique was being replaced by GoMotion, an advanced form of animation with motorized puppets that move while the camera shutter is open. However, GoMotion was too expensive for the budget of the Ewoks film, so stop motion was used to realize creatures such as the Gorax. The Ewok legend was based on Tibetan language. Huh, interesting. The film takes place between the events of Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back, and Star Wars Empire Episode 6, The Return of the Jedi. The movie was finished in six weeks of shooting, 1 week of reshoot, and 2 weeks of dubbing. That's pretty quick. That's really, really quick. And this was the first part of the two made for TV spin-offs from the original Star Wars saga. Fans remain split as to whether they should be considered as part of the official Star Wars canon. Since Disney acquired Lucasfilms, this has become part of Legends, which is therefore not canon. Some people feel it, and its other Ewok movies should receive special edition capable of making them canon, especially due to include original trilogy actor Warwick Davis as Wicket the Ewok. The main change would be removing the Ewok speaking human language. They were released on Disney Plus on April 21st, 2021. You were not a big Star Wars fan, were you?
No, Professor? I'm not.
Star Trek?
Yep.
Anyway, so what have you got for the next few days, Professor?
Still hitting my head against the wall with this NAS.
It's a never-ending battle. Meanwhile, as for me, I'm going to try and get back into the MOBA games. I might try and play the Dota game or two and see how I go with it. It's been a while, so let's see how I go with it. It will end badly, I'll tell you that much. Anyways, that's all we have for this week. Where can they find us, Professor?
Check out our shorts on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I think that's about it.
Yeah, yeah, and that's not canon.com with an archive of episodes. And any other audio platforms you can find our podcast in. Anyways, that's all we have for this week. Look after yourself, stay hydrated. And all rise for the Sith.
We'll see you next week.
Here we go!
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.